Come on, we are not going to get relief by turning back to the very same policies that for the last 8 years doubled the national debt and threw our economy into a tailspin.
Where were you when everything was falling apart? All my days spent by telephone.
Hi, and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. It's Friday, February 6th. Today on the podcast, we'll be traveling to the country of Irresponsibilistan.
I recommend it.
Excellent. You're taking us there, right, David?
Yeah, they have very nice beaches.
It's actually not as far a trip as you might think. Once we get there, we're going to talk about what it means when a country goes deeply into debt.
First, our Planet Money indicator is 598,000. That is the number of jobs the economy lost in January, and it was the third consecutive month when we've lost over 500,000 jobs.
Which brings the unemployment rate now to 7.6%, up from 7.2%. And to go along with this number, that we have our own Planet Money indicator, and it has to do with a telephone in San Francisco this week that got 6 to 8 calls every second.
It's a phone line at a AM radio station, KGO AM 810 in San Francisco, and they were doing this one-hour sell yourself segment. So basically, people who had just lost their jobs got a chance to call in and come on the air and sell themselves to try and get a job.
Michael is calling from Roanoke Park.
Hi, my name is Michael Colisi, and like so many others, Monday I went into work. I was working on a project in Dubai, and after lunch, got told I was laid off. I work in the construction industry for probably the largest construction company I worked in the Bay Area, Kiewit Pacific, and they built the Bay Bridge and the Benicia Bridge, and I did estimating for them, superintendent, and just pretty much everything.
That's what counts. And you've been doing it for how long?
8 years.
8 years. How do people get in touch with you, Michael?
You can reach me at...
Well, you could actually hear him flipping through his resume there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. It's crazy. He sounded really shaken up, too. As did the host of the show, Ron Owens. He actually was pretty taken aback by the whole thing. It seemed like it took him by surprise a little bit.
I have no idea how many calls we wound up taking during the course of the hour. But as I said, when you get 6 to 8 calls per second, kind of indicates how real it is. And for those of us who are working, maybe just listen to this hour and realize no matter what, could be worse and hopefully things will be better for those people who called in.
One of the things, obviously, that would hopefully get people back to work is the stimulus package being debated in Congress. The intent would be to spend something like, could be $900 billion. But of course, that comes with a cost.
Which is that that money has to come from somewhere. And so, David, and this brings us to Irresponsibilistan, right? You talked with our friend Simon Johnson from the Peterson Institute about where that money comes from.
Yeah, because he and his colleagues, James Quack at the blog Baseline Scenario, they wrote this really great primer on this. We have a version on our website. And they imagined a country called Irresponsibilistan.
And Irresponsibilistan, in their scenario, decides it needs to spend money, more money than it actually has. So it does what we're about to do. It borrows it by issuing bonds, treasuries.
Right. So people in this country, people in other countries will lend the government money by buying a treasury bond, and the government pays them back with a little bit of interest. So I started by asking Simon Johnson, is this a good idea for Irresponsibilistan, going into debt?
I guess you should think about it a little bit like an individual who wants to go to school or a company that has a really great technology to invest in. If you think that you have good prospects down the road, so you go to college, you'll get a much higher wage typically than if you don't go to college. It's worth investing. It's worth borrowing, actually, the money to so you can go to college and get that great education, or so you can develop a technology that you can sell for a lot of money subsequently. And then, of course, you can pay down the debt.
So you shouldn't wait until you've earned enough money waiting tables to pay for 4 years of college necessarily. Right. That's in a situation where it makes sense to borrow.
I think that's a very good that's a good way to pose the question, because that's exactly the calculation that individuals do and that countries do. You could save it all up year by year And then go to college. But that'll take a long time, particularly with tuition where it is today. Or you could borrow money, and hopefully you'll borrow on good terms. Hopefully there are people out there who regard you as a good credit risk, and they'll charge a reasonable rate of interest. Perhaps they'll defer the interest for a while until you graduate from college. And that's a good deal both for the person who goes to college and for the people who lend you money. And I would emphasize also for college professors.
The big question here, I think, is how much debt is okay? Because we're obviously talking about the United States here, right? And the Congressional Budget Office most recent estimate was that we are going to just in 1 year incur over $1 trillion of debt, right? So how much debt is okay? What do we know about that?
Well, it's like all the great questions in economics. The answer is not very much. Or maybe we know a lot, but it's not as helpful as it should be. Basically, we know that if you get over-indebted, that's bad because you can't roll over the debt. You can't get people to lend you new money. And that's an issue, for example, right now in some European countries, for example, that have debt-to-GDP ratio, so the amount of government debt they owe relative to the size of their economy, is large. And not to pick on anyone in particular, but in Greece, for example, this ratio, debt-to-GDP, is about 90%. And that's a high level, and depending on what happens to their interest rates and to their growth rate, that could be trouble.
And that, just to be clear what that means that in 1 year, the amount of goods and services, the amount of stuff they produce, right, that sort of their income, you might think of it, right, they would have to devote 90% of that if they wanted to pay off all the debt they had.
Exactly. If you wanted to or had to pay it off in 1 year, it would be almost all of your income, which, of course, would be a terrible thing, and no one would ever be able to do that. But it gives you a sense of the claims that are out there on your income. In the United States, right now, our debt-to-GDP ratio is around 40%, 41%, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which is less than half the Greek level. And that's a level that most people would regard as medium high. It's not a low debt level. It's medium. Greece is high. We're medium. There are a few countries around the world that have low debt, but not very many.
What's the highest ours has been historically?
That's a great question. After World War II, we had very high debt. Different estimates put that between 120, 140% of GDP. That was obviously due to wanting to borrow from our own citizens in order to finance the war effort. And that debt was paid down fairly quickly, in particular because there was substantial growth after World War II. The highest the debt has been recently was 1996, when it peaked at 67% of GDP. So quite a bit higher than what we have today.
Can you sketch out a little bit exactly what the danger is of running such a big debt? Is that people worry that we won't be able to pay it back and the United States, you know, could end as we know it? Or what is the actual fear?
The actual fear is exactly that. The fear is that you take on a lot of debt, you think you'll be able to handle it, and all of a sudden the world changes, your prospects go down, your citizens refuse to pay taxes, and you can't pay the debt. And this was a big question, actually, at the founding of the American Republic. How much of the debt that had been accumulated in the struggle for independence should be paid off by this new state? And Alexander Hamilton, among others, but very decisively, Hamilton said we should honor the debt. It's really critical for the creation of a viable state and for building a reputation that we honor all the debt that's out there that was used to pay people who worked who were in the Continental Army, for example. And that's a fundamental principle for the United States and for good governments everywhere. And the danger is that you'll take your eye off the ball, you'll overborrow, and you'll get in over your head. And at that point, there'll be no alternative other than to skip some payments. And skipping payments on your national debt is not like skipping a payment or two on your credit card. It immediately and irreparably damages your reputation.
And then, for instance, it gets harder and harder to borrow, and you have to pay higher interest rates, and you have more problems, right, along the way. Before
That's
the
exactly.
United States actually ends, it gets very, very bumpy.
Yes, the United States is not going to end. But what would happen is the cost to us of new borrowing would go up. And you know, a big chunk of what we do spend every year of our government budget is interest payments. Now, if interest rates right now on government debt are extremely low, we can borrow long-term at 2% or a bit more than 2%, which is remarkably low by historical standards. If there was a significant risk of default, you would be paying a much higher interest rate. And if you look, for example, at what's happening in Greece to the Greek government, their interest rates are going up steadily as people begin to worry about whether they might, down the road, in the not-too-distant future, skip a payment or two.
Okay, here's the big ending, the big reveal, the big twist to the movie. Is Irresponsibilistan really the United States?
No, it's not. Not yet, not now, and not with the policies we see. But let me put it like this. I sat down with a senior experienced Italian government official earlier this week to review what we're doing in the United States and what will happen in terms of our fiscal position and our debt. And at the end of the conversation, we went through all the numbers for about 5 minutes. He looked at me and he said, "So you're going to end up with the debt to GDP ratio." Remember, this critical measure of how much debt we have in the U.S. He said, "This debt to GDP ratio, when you're done with the stimulus and getting through the recession and bailing out the banks and sorting out housing, this ratio is going to be very close to what it is in Italy today." Italy is between 80 and 90%. And I said, "Yes, that's what it looks like." And he shook his head sadly and said, "Well, that will make things more difficult down the road."
Thank you to Simon Johnson. And it's really exciting, actually, about Simon. He's agreed to co-host Planet Money from time to time. We're very excited about that. And so you can look for him in the next couple of weeks sharing the hosting duties here in the booth with me or David or Adam or Laura. And if you go to our blog, npr.org/money, you can read that primer that Simon and James Quack wrote. We travel now, though, from Irresponsibilistan to Pajamistan.
Pajamistan is Cambodia, where actually a lot of pajamas are made. In fact, the vast majority, I mean, incredibly, the vast majority of Cambodia's economy is just making clothing. I was there for a while teaching journalism, and like T-shirts, you know, when you walk through the markets, the open markets, there are just T-shirts after T-shirt after T-shirt, usually with Angkor advertising Angkor beer on it, or Angkor Wat, the ancient temples that everyone goes to see, or some a company that does demining, taking mines out of the ground after they're still there from the Khmer Rouge.
So it's a T-shirt and pajama based economy. Has that actually been working for them?
Well, I mean, it was great up until right about now, actually.
Right, and this story that we're about to hear is it's a story about the big consequences of small actions. And to set the stage, we want to start by playing you a part of a story that we did on This American Life a while ago. It's by Rachel Louise Snyder, who lives in Cambodia.
The garment industry is 90% of Cambodia's exports. So when the Minister of Commerce visits a factory, he's greeted like a movie star. Hundreds of workers, all of them women, stand along the factory driveway in traditional Cambodian silk dresses, in maroon and gold, waving hundreds of Cambodian flags. They offer the minister flowers and fruit. As he walks through each section of the factory, workers stand up from their stations and cheer. Plexiglass cases hang from the ceilings and show the kinds of things they make. Fleece sweatshirts, cotton blankets, flannel pajamas. The minister, Cham Prasit, is particularly happy about the pajamas.
There is one thing that we feel very proud is that there is one year when Cambodia was ranking number one in terms of pajamas, women's pajamas for...
Women's pajamas?
Yes. That's mean 20 million American women are wearing Cambodian pajamas. And we are ranking number one for that in the U.S. Sleeping soundly and having sweet dreams. They hope they would have also thinking of Cambodians who are producing this for them.
They're not, of course, and that's Cambodia's entire problem in a nutshell. The clothing business has transformed Cambodia in a way most Americans can't imagine and know absolutely nothing about. In the 1970s, between 1 and 2 million Cambodians died, about a third of the population, in the country's civil war. The Khmer Rouge eliminated business of every kind, and even money itself. The middle class was slaughtered. For 2 decades after that, the country's economy was flattened, and chronic drought affected hundreds of thousands of families. But in the mid-90s, outside investors began opening garment factories, and within 5 years, clothes were the country's biggest export. 2 things made this possible. First, an international quota system implemented decades ago kept any one country from being the sole provider of clothes to the American and European markets. That meant more than 50 countries got a shot at the industry. The second thing was that under the Clinton administration, Cambodia was part of an extraordinary experiment. It got special access to U.S. markets in exchange for good conditions for workers and factory monitoring by the International Labor Organization. The Cambodians didn't just make child labor in sweatshops illegal. They adopted some of the most progressive labor laws in the world. 8-hour workdays, paid overtime, 3 months maternity leave, 43 days vacation, annual health checkups, and free health clinics on site. The access Cambodia got to U.S. and European markets made the industry explode, growing from nothing to 250 factories in just 10 years. The experiment was a huge success.
So that story originally aired in 2005. And what happened next is that the special trade status that she mentioned that the U.S. gave to Cambodia went away. And that could have been disastrous for Cambodia, except for these pieces of paper I have in my hand here. Mm-hmm. This is the trade agreement. It's a trade agreement that actually has absolutely nothing to do with Cambodia, at least not directly.
Can I see one of these
pieces
of paper? So what you are holding in your hand here is a it's called the China Textile Safeguard Agreement.
Yep.
And what it does is basically limits the amount of clothing that we in the U.S. will take from China.
Right, from China. And it was basically – the idea is to protect the U.S. textile industry.
So by trying to protect the U.S. textile industry and by trying to stick it to China, we've actually –
Right. It kept the door open for Cambodia because Cambodia is like, oh, China can't sell too much to the United States. That's awesome. We can still sell our pajamas, even if the Chinese pajamas are cheaper. They're still going to have to buy from us. So
because we don't have enough domestic producers of pajamas
a separate crisis, which we'll have another show on.
to clothe the sleeping populace of America.
Right. Yeah, but the problem was that this textile safeguard agreement, literally 1 month ago, it expired. So we called Rachel Louise Snyder, who did that story, to ask her what happened in Cambodia.
Well, it's interesting. You know, people were kind of watching the clock and waiting for this implosion, right, in the Cambodian garment industry. But what ended up happening is that the entire world went into recession. And so even China is struggling in terms of its manufacturing and its exports. And Cambodia is... Yeah, having a very difficult time, but it's hard to say whether or not it's going to be more affected by the overall global recession or more affected by the fact that China has unfettered access to the U.S. market right now. I think it's going to be very difficult to make a distinction in the next year or two.
Right. So,
you know, which one of those has a bigger effect on Cambodia? All we can say for sure is that Cambodia is headed down a very bumpy road.
So what's it like there now, actually? I assume you've gone out and looked at what's that road where all the garment factories are?
Well, there's two main areas just outside of Phnom Penh, but Chak Ong Ri is the area that I've gone to a number of times. You know, it's...
It used to be people were spilling out into the streets, buying, at least in the evenings, you know, buying stuff at all those stalls. It was just happening.
Yeah, and it's definitely less so. In the last year alone, 30 factories have closed in Cambodia. That's the largest number of factory closings in the history of the garment industry in Cambodia.
What were the kind of fair labor standards that they have? I remember you mentioned that there were breaks for breastfeeding for new mothers.
Yeah, the Cambodian labor standards were based on French labor standards, so they're very, very similar. So garment workers got breastfeeding breaks. They have medical clinics. They're supposed to, by law, have medical clinics in their factories. They got vacations. They got paid holidays. And they had the right. They have the right to unionize and to strike and to form and reform unions. So it's quite a good system. I have to say, with the economic downturn, there has been more and more talk of whether or not Cambodia is going to be able to sustain their decent working conditions. And in fact, there are a lot of stories of worker intimidation, of regression. I heard a story recently of a factory subcontracting out to women in prison, and they were paid about $2.50 a month. So there's fear that, you know, in the face of such economic woes, the first thing to go could possibly be these labor standards that they've worked so hard to keep up over the years.
Yeah, I mean, the tension in this story is like, you know, Cambodia did something you just feel great about, right? They're like employing people and they're making their lives livable and helping them make their own lives better, and they're making products that the world is buying, right? And yet, if they're really opened up to, you know, to unfettered competition, they're going to get beat, right? Because everyone's costs are lower in part because of that. So, what is the answer here?
Well, you know that, and you bring that up, and you're absolutely right, and it's really depressing because a country like Bangladesh, that is in fact in the garment industry, notorious for terrible working conditions and sweatshops and that kind of thing, has even in the last couple of years of economic trouble seen significant growth. So what does that say about us when a country like Bangladesh that doesn't have the labor standards of Cambodia is allowed to flourish and Cambodia just struggles and struggles and struggles? You know, the answer is, frankly, that they need to diversify their economy. They cannot just rely on garments. But also, they need to improve their productivity and they need to diminish some of the red tape and the corruption that exists in Cambodia. You know, they've got good labor rights, it's true, in the garment industry. But they also, right along with that, paralleling that, is some of the worst corruption in the world. But it's just a terrifying time. I think Cambodia is really at a critical juncture right now because they need to keep up their good labor standards, and there's increased evidence that they're not doing it very well. So, you know, it's the one thing they have right now that no other country has. The only thing.
All right, that was Rachel Louise Snyder. Her book is called Fugitive Denim. It's about all this stuff that's happening in Cambodia, right? And we'll link to it on our blog, npr.org/money. And, you know, just speaking of Rachel's story, we have another big hour-long special that we're putting together that the Planet Money team is putting together with This American Life. It's going to be an hour-long special on This American Life, and then parts of it are going to be airing on Planet Money and on NPR.
It's about banking. Exciting.
It's about banking. And specifically, why in the world is the government giving hundreds of billions of dollars to banks? It's like literally you're taking tax-paying dollars from working men and women and giving it to the richest people and corporations in the world.
And there actually is a reason, and you'll hear from the people who think it's a good idea. You might not like it, but, you know, they don't really like it either. But I promise it'll be – we'll find some upbeat note to end on, yeah? We're still missing that part. So if you have any ideas.
No, we'll find something, yeah. No, I mean it actually is really, really interesting. There's a very tricky tightrope that the government has to walk here, and we're going to talk all about what's going on. It's you know, it's unprecedented territory, but there actually is sort of – there's thinking behind what they're doing. So,
all right. That's it for today. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Thank you for listening.